Hi everyone, welcome to Into the Unknown, a show on three stories of people facing isolating situations in their lives. I'm your host, Subi Anandaraja.
And I'm your other host, Nicole Edwards. These people you're about to meet are all starting some pretty unpredictable life journeys. Some end well, some don't.
Without further ado, let's dive in.
A popular narrative about Canada is one that says we're a welcoming and multicultural mosaic. But a 2018 Statistics Canada report shows roughly 1 in 7 people who immigrate to Canada decide to leave within 5 years. In fact, journalist Doug Saunders says keeping immigrants has been a problem for Canada since Confederation. Our first story on Leaping into the Unknown tries to find out why. This story contains strong language and might offend some listeners.
I'm Margaret Miller.
And I'm Ron Miller.
We moved from Glasgow, Scotland to Toronto, Canada.
We moved here when we got married, 6 months after we were married, and landed here on April 14th, 1969.
I was the same age as what my granddaughter is now,
21.
Driving down Eglinton Avenue, and you had all these lights, neon lights, and it just looked absolutely humongous. And when we arrived, it was hot. 75 degrees, and he'd on a wool suit, and I had on a wool suit, and shirt and tie, and the whole bit, and it was we were dying.
Going through the immigration when we landed here, at that time they ask you, how much money you've got, you're coming to Canada with. We had the equivalent of $350. It was a lot of money then, and they basically were putting us down almost as destitute. And they gave us the address of this hotel downtown Toronto because we didn't have any family or anything here. And it's gone now, but it was a Ford hotel, which was near the bus station, the old Bay Street bus station, and I think it's still there. And little did we know when we got there that there was a hotel where guys used to pick up women, the prostitutes, and take them there as well. So we were in the elevator going up, and those guys in the elevator looking at me and looking at Margaret.
Our suitcases.
And we were suitcase, and they're looking at us as if to say,
I guess we fitted in the sense that a lot of the friends we had came from Britain, whether they were English or Scottish or Irish or whatever. But Canadians, no so much.
So they used to say, as they say, you're over here just for a few years to take the money,
and
you're going to go back. That's exactly what they said. You're going to go back to Scotland and stuff like that. And we were stunned.
And some of the people I worked with, especially in the Bank of Nova Scotia, they weren't very nice.
I went to the employment office to sign on right as soon as I got here. And they would say to me, do you have any Canadian experience? And I go, what do you mean Canadian experience? Well, how much Canadian experience have you got? I said, well, I've been working for 2 months or, a month in this machine shop. No, we're looking for people that's got at least a year or 2 years Canadian experience. That's everywhere I went. IBM, General Electric, all the big jobs, the big employers in Scarborough who hired people like me. And that was the thing. It was, do you have Canadian experience? You can't say, well, why are you not hiring me? I've got all this experience, and I had engineering degrees as well, right? So it's just a way of being nicely saying, well, you're not getting the job, and instead of saying, well, why? It's just you don't have a Canadian experience.
That, of course, becomes a major, major issue in terms of why people might encounter economic disappointment. It certainly goes against that branding of, Canada as a welcoming country to the world through immigration. I'm Meyer Simiatiki. I'm a professor in the Department of Politics and Public Administration. I am the past founding director of Ryerson's graduate program, MA program in Immigration and Settlement Studies. One of my areas of teaching and research interest is migration. So we're trying to explain why does a 1 in 7 minority not find this a happy landing pad? And I think in addition to the economic conditions, which I think are the major factor, I think another one that plays in is, can they cope with a change in their own social status and place in a society? I think it's a subjective response to lived experience. I would put in a second category, this is a terrible thing for anyone to be subjected to, a significant self-perceived decline in their place in the social hierarchy or positioning of where they are in their society. So a lot of it then comes down to, if you're going to be confronted with that, can you handle that?
I went to a job site. It was north of Frankfurt, north of Trenton, and there was a non-union job getting done somewhere. So I gets out of the car and I walks up, this guy's standing, you know. And I said, excuse me, I says, who's doing the mechanical part of this job here on this gate? And the guy turns around and says, what's it to you? I says, I'm the union rep. I says, we represent the contractors that do this work. I'm very interested in who's doing it. Well, then it started. You tell me that some foreign-born cocksucker is going to come in my job site and tell me who's going to be installing work on my job. You've got a fucking problem, he says. I went, fucking fire away then, let's do it. This is 1990, I'd say four or five, right? So 25 years ago, and I was still that foreign-born cocksucker. And I don't look Asian, I don't look brown. Till I opened my mouth, he didn't know what I was, right? And just because I opened my mouth and I said that, I was a foreign-born cocksucker. I would say a lot of the attitudes changed later on, maybe later in the 70s. But then there was a different kind of, almost if you want to call it, a different kind of racism. Because now they weren't worried about us. They were worried about immigrants that were coming from other places that they didn't particularly like. And then their attitude changes. You know, you're okay. When we were the same people that came here in 1969.
How far then have we really come in the 50 years since Ron and Margaret arrived? The good news is services are improving and local advocates are now saying Canadian experience isn't a requirement employers can demand. That story was produced by Tiffany Lamb.
Our second story is about a mother who navigates the unknown as she searches for her missing son. Putting aside her fears as a racialized woman, Maureen Henry went to the police, but didn't find much support. This story is produced by Nicole Edwards. And a quick heads up to listeners, our next story talks about sexual assault and suicide.
But he was really like a good kid. Like, I can show you pictures of him playing soccer and he's got artwork here, his writing.
Did he always want to go to UT?
Well, he said he did. It was his dream.
Yeah.
Because I remember sitting down with him at the computer and choosing the selections. Yeah. Sociology and philosophy. I remember the weekend he came home and he said, oh, Mom, I met these brothers. I'm thinking, what brothers? Some fraternity brothers, and I'm going to move into their house. What exactly was going on in the house? What did they do to him? What did he do? He talked about experimenting with drugs with those guys. Like, I don't know. So there's an air of something really traumatic that happened to Dovey in between the time that I saw him in August and the time that he ended up back home at Christmas time. So he was drunk in one of the parties at that house, and some guy came on to him and what else did the guy do to you when you were stoned out of your mind or drunk? Okay, he was talking about it like traumatized, talking about it like somebody who had been sexually assaulted. That's how Dovey seemed to me. We're at like an impasse, so we're stuck at with the people at Beta Theta Pi, okay, and those people at Beta Theta Pi will not talk. And I don't know if you knew Ralph Agard. Okay, he was a psychologist in Toronto. And then I called Ralph and said, Ralph, like, have you heard from Dovey? I think at one point he said he had heard from Dovey and he and Dovi was supposed to come in and see him. We both communicated with him and saw him, let's say March, right? Then, and I think I might have been emailing him and calling him to find out where he was. No response. And then we were contacting friends. No response. And then from there, I kept calling my mother and sister and asking, have you heard from Dovi? Have you heard from Dovi? Friends, have you heard from Dovi? Then we contacted the Salvation Army. And the Salvation Army did a family find. And they couldn't locate him either. And then I'd call my mother and sister and say, we need to report Dovi missing. And they say, no, you can't call the Toronto police, because if the Toronto police find him, they're going to kill him or they're going to hurt him. Because she said that was at that point, that was when the Toronto police were killing all those black boys and people with mental health issues. I call the Toronto police to report it. We don't know where Dovi lives. And then they said that they would go and contact Facebook to see if they could get the IP address. Nothing was ever done. So we hired the private investigator.
May I please speak with Gary Foxwell?
Can I please ask who's calling?
Yeah, it's Nicole Edwards. We had a call scheduled for 10:30.
We're kind of a boutique investigative firm. We're a one-stop shop, pretty much, for almost anything you can think of that has to be investigated. A lot of people do come to us because they want, they have the resources, which vis-a-vis money, and they want things done like yesterday.
Because they told us it would cost us $15,000. So far, we've spent over $6,000. They're kind of at a standstill, and so we thought these guys would be efficient, and we would find out more than what we did, but so far, we haven't really found out anything.
Because we're all retired police officers here, we fall back on our police training primarily. It's kind of almost mirror what you'd expect from a police department if they're taking a missing persons complaint. So we try and get as much evidence and as much identifying factors as possible from whoever's making the request. And the more information that they can provide, the higher success rate we have.
All he did was contact the people that I directed him to. So throughout the 2 years until I found him, I'd call the Toronto police, then I phoned the jails, and then I phoned the big mental institution in Toronto.
CAMH.
Yep, couldn't find him. Then I phoned, Then I phoned the morgue. He wasn't speaking to me because he was dead.
There should be a national database for DNA on missing people. So I know that there's been talk about it for years, and I think a lot has to do with there's a lot of people out there that are really maybe over-concerned about people's privacy. And I get that. I totally understand people's privacy rights and all that. But like, let's be specific about Dovi's case. You know, if Dovi's mom had been, you know, said, okay, he's missing. Well, here's a sample of my DNA, which should match up to my son's DNA. Or maybe she got a sample of the DNA, some hair on a brush or whatever it may take. So any kind of if the missing person's remains are located, the first thing that goes is a database and run the DNA.
The coroner's report says his death was undetermined. The Toronto police say suicide. Like, they really piss me off. Every single time I call, they're telling me that Dovi committed suicide. And they just keep parroting and mocking. He committed suicide. He committed suicide. He committed suicide over and over and over like a broken record. He was just wonderful. He didn't give trouble. He read books. We would have amazing conversation. He would cook. He was he was really, for me, right? I had decided I was going to give him the best life that I could, he could have, and I tried my best.
In the wake of Bruce MacArthur, the police force in Toronto is overhauling their procedure for investigating missing people. Old cases are even being reopened to make sure they were conducted properly. Dovie Henry's case isn't on their list. Our very last story will take you through a day that changed a girl's life forever. 28-year-old Florence Rudbarani shares her story about being diagnosed with an incurable disease. After months of unexplained symptoms, multiple tests proved Florence's worst fears true. Listen to Florence express her struggle to accept her unknown, the future of her life.
My name is Florence Rudbarani, and I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. I was diagnosed on May 23rd, 2013. I was 23 years old. A couple months prior to getting diagnosed, I remember I was experiencing certain symptoms, and it was very out of the ordinary, and I don't know, I was just very confused, very worried. I started researching it online and seeing the different diagnoses that would pop up. So I decided to contact my doctor to get some testing done, and I remember a couple weeks later I got a call from the doctor's office. When I went to the doctor's office, I didn't tell my family members about why I was going because I didn't want them to freak out on something that potentially could be nothing. But inside, I did feel like there was something wrong, and I knew that the news would not be good. And I ended up going to the doctor's with a friend. I remember going there, and the doctor said, "It's unfortunate, but you are diagnosed with MS, and we'll have to just refer you to the MS clinic nearby." So it was not like I didn't expect it, but I just didn't want to hear it. I just didn't want it to be what it was. After being diagnosed, I left the doctor's office, and I remember my friend was waiting outside in the waiting area. And he just saw me crying, and he came up to me and said, "What's wrong?" And I told him, I guess my worst fears came true. I told him about the diagnosis, and he kept on saying, "Are you sure? Maybe you should get a second opinion." But inside, I knew that what the doctors were telling me were right. I didn't know what it was, and to be honest, I was quite healthy, you know. I would work out, I would go for jogs, I would eat healthy, I never liked sweet things. And so, I never thought that something like this would happen to me. It was quite scary, like, to know that just out of the blue, you get a very horrible disease. When I went home from the doctor's office, I literally was in bed all day. And I was basically sobbing. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I turned off my phone. Luckily, my cats were nearby, and they always made me feel better. So, and I did have family, but I just didn't want to tell them what was happening at that time.
My name is Shanaz. I'm Florence's mom. I think she's disappointed. She feels end of the world. I don't blame her. She's an educated person. She has had a lot of dreams that it's dying inside her. So I wish I could change that, but I know it's hard.
I went through a stage like everyone. They go through a stage of denial, and I was in denial for at least maybe 3 years. I knew, I felt like I could, you know, do something about it. It could not happen to me. I was too young to be going through it. I didn't know what to expect. You know, it was something new. I never heard about this disease before, so it was very new to me, and I was more just scared of the future. I just felt like maybe I did something wrong in life and I was being punished. It wasn't a good feeling because I kind of lost faith in everything. I was hopeless. I was very lost. I just knew that there was no cure for this disease. If I could go back and tell myself something, I would definitely tell myself to just continue living life and don't be scared of the future, because fear really does paralyze a person. I would just say, don't let the fear eat you up and don't let it affect how you live your life.
Being diagnosed with MS or any illness is a scary process. The road to acceptance is not always easy and is often lonely. Florence shows us exactly how one day can unexpectedly change your life forever and how to navigate through the dark. That story was produced by Sogan Jalali.
Today, you heard stories from Tiffany Lam, Nicole Edwards, and Sogan Jalali.
Thanks to my co-host, Sui Anandaraja, and our tech, Angela Glover.
And thanks to my co-host, Nicole Edwards. Head over to the RSJ Radio website to see photos of all the characters you met in today's stories about venturing into the unknown.
Thanks for listening.